Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hold your Nellies there, sister.
Hold your Nellies.
Look at that. Cher Morris. Boom. Molly and I are talking weird stuff, and Cher's like, no, start the music. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rudolph.
I am Molly Wood.
Oh, my God. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, our podcast that connects all things tech, culture, and economic, I think, right? Isn't that
That's
what we
right.
say? Something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Okay. And then sometimes we sneak in some other things that we feel like talking about. None of us, as it turns out, thank you for joining us, sneaking in the things that you feel like talking about.
Oh, my tea is very hot.
I like to be straightforward with these things. Kai's getting sick, so we're going to lean heavily on you all today because none of us is as smart as all of us. And if we sound a little delirious, a little full of avoidance, a little, a little punchy, if you will, it's because it's, as we are recording this, it is the midterm elections day. It is literally election day as we're recording this, and you'll probably hear it toward the end of the day or tomorrow. By the time this episode comes out, results will be coming in, most likely. Maybe you'll be listening to this while you're still in line waiting to vote. Maybe in Georgia, where apparently people showed up to vote and none of the machines were working. Just saying.
Wow.
We hope you vote over here because, as a certain Mr. Rizdahl is fond of saying, elections have consequences. I heard that today on a different podcast and I was like, I know where you got that.
Yeah. Did I get the credit or no?
No.
Lame-os.
I think we should send an email.
We totally should. We should send an invoice. Intellectual property. So look, we're going to do things a little different today just because it's a different kind of day and there's a lot going on and emotions are running high on both sides of basically all issues. And the question we want to start with is actually the Make Me Smart question, but it's really in this context. Yes, something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. But the nub of it today is, how you feeling? How you feeling at a time in this country when almost no matter where you are on the political spectrum, there is something going on that maybe you're not too fond of. So anyway, here is our version of the Make Me Smart question, Election Day 2018.
I thought most people treated others as they wanted to be treated, but apparently empathy is not that common. Being an empath is actually a rare occurrence. Most people don't feel what others are feeling on the same level.
I used to think that when it comes to difficult conversations, whether about discrimination, sexual assault, etc., if someone could just hear a true story, someone's personal experience, that it would change their mind. But, and this is where you can cue the dark mode, I've discovered recently that while personal stories can be compelling, they can also fuel the backfire effect, where the person listening digs in deeper to their own beliefs and perspectives. I now see true stories as one part of the path toward empathy.
I live in Pittsburgh, in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood, not far from the Tree of Life Synagogue. I thought empathy was a learned trait, that once you had empathy, that was it. But I'm wrong about that. Empathy is something that needs to be constantly worked at and continuously updated to the people and situations that surround me.
So, while letting that one hang there for just a second, that was Ben Cornelius Based, also Teresa Nichols and Laura Tyson before him. As I said, it's a serious time for a lot of reasons in this society, in this economy. And what we try to do here on this podcast is have some of those serious conversations. All right, the producers are going to yell at me for this. While maybe not taking ourselves too seriously, how about that? Which goes back to the roots of Make Me Smart, why we're doing what we're doing. And what we decided to do Election Day on the theory that all y'all are swamped with news and all that other stuff is go back to one of the early conversations we had. I think it was like near the beginning of the first year we were doing this, Molly, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, early on. I mean, it was maybe one of our third or fourth episode. No, I'm sorry. It's right here. Episode 12. And it made it here in the rundown also notes that this week is episode 89. So we have come a long way. And yet, surprisingly, many things have stayed the same. All the way back to April 2017, we talked to George Lakoff, a professor emeritus at Berkeley. He studies and writes about philosophy and cognitive linguistics. His 1996 book, Moral Politics, was huge, right? That is when everybody knew about George Lakoff. And, you know, we were lucky enough to sort of go back and find him at, I think, another pivotal moment in American society and say, hey, tell us again about all those things that you were thinking about, you know, cognitive linguistics and how it affects politics. And since then, I'm just saying he's been all over the place. And I think it's because we're all trying to figure, I mean, it really is interesting that all the answers we got that we put in the show, yes, that we chose, but that empathy is this common theme, that we actually want to be better, even though we are in this incredibly divided political moment. And yet something about our society and maybe even our brains is stopping us from being better. And like, we can't figure out why that's happening. So it seemed like a good time to go back to George Lakoff. We're going to take three major points from our interview with him and see how they apply now and mm-hmm. frankly, how we feel about them.
The first part we're going to take is about us, really. It's the way media enables misinformation and how, honestly, journalists can do better. Here he is, George Lakoff. You're critical, actually, of how the media is covering Mr. Trump and the words we are using. So what are we to do when our job is, in theory, to inform rather than persuade?
Excellent. What you do is, first of all, understand he's probably trying to get away from anything important you're saying that's true. So say your important truths first. Always preempt with the truth. Frame first with the truth and with what is important. Next, if he has a diversion about something unimportant, he's attacking Meryl Streep or something, you again point out that there's a diversion and you talk about whatever is true there about it. Then if he has a tweet, and his tweets are all strategic to divert your attention from other things or to do preemptive.
That's what I've been saying. Sorry, that's what I've been saying.
You've
on
hit
Twitter
on Kai's obsession.
A year and a half.
By the way, you are absolutely right. I have a little diagram for you. And, Molly has it, you know, that goes through the four types of tweets. And it shows you exactly what you've been saying. You're absolutely right. There are four types. One is there's a preemptive framing. Second, there is diversion. You talk about Meryl Streep instead of what's important, instead of the Russians. Then there is attack the messenger. You attack the press or whoever. And last, there are trial balloons. You say, oh, everybody should have nuclear weapons or whatever, and you see if that's taken seriously. Or some combination of those. Those are the four types of tweets, and they're all strategic. They're all used strategically. He is not just staying up at night having nightmares and having weird emotions and so on. He's strategic.
Right? I mean, a lot of that was spot on, and it's interesting that it was a year and a half ago and how things have sort of changed but not really changed, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, or arguably not changed at all and gotten way worse.
Yeah, conceivably. There's that,
I don't
too.
Know.
There's that, too.
I mean, it's interesting to have gotten those warnings, to have realized the kind of, I don't know, parasitic or self-serving, the worm that eats its own head situation that always has been Trump in the media. Ouroboros.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry. I really love it. It's like one of those things where I was like, that'd be a cool tattoo, but I'm not 22 anymore. But it would be.
Oh, you ruined it now for me forever.
Oh, yeah. No, it's over. Ouroboros is dead to us now. But it's a great metaphor for, I think, the very symbiotic relationship that the media unquestionably has with President Trump, had leading up to the election and continues
still
to
has.
Have.
1,000%.
I mean, to a degree that causes me to privately rant constantly about the headlines. I mean, and even publicly, we talked about this just recently with credulism. Credulism?
Credulousness.
Credulity.
Right. Good for you. Ouroboros.
But, you know, we see, and, you know, we talked about this a lot with George Lakoff, this framing thing. We see the media constantly pick up the framing and repeat the framing. One of the things that he told us was that even by attempting to debunk, right, even if you say, here are the six falsehoods that were in President Trump's USA Today op-ed on Medicare, You've essentially repeated them and given them power. Yep. The one that was making me insane recently was NPR. Sorry. And other outlets,
hey man,
too, but particularly NPR, which I listen to. Yeah, exactly. Hey, listeners, guess what? We're not actually NPR.
not that you care, and never mind. That was a tangent, but go ahead.
I know, totally. It's like a little inside situation, little hangnail for us. Every time during the pipe bomb situation where pipe bombs were being sent to all these Democrats and one actor, every time that was reported on NPR, and I listened to Up First and, you know, Morning Edition and All Things Considered, they said that this man was sending pipe bombs to prominent Trump critics. Like, think about how dystopian that is, for one thing.
Wait, what's your objection? Is your objection the use of the word Trump critics?
Yes, because they're Democrats. They're politicians, sitting politicians, a former vice president. I mean, how do you think Joe Biden feels about being reduced to the moniker Trump critic? It just felt really 1984 to me. It was like, what? Why wouldn't you just say prominent Democrats or politicians or major figures in American life? It was just a bizarre usage that to me points out the fact that for the media right now, everything is about Trump.
Well, that's true. That is true. That is true.
But you disagree?
I'm not as struck by it as you are, you know, but that's...
Okay, know, good.
Yeah.
Lakoff point number two. You ready?
Born ready, yo.
Point. His second point was this, that you live life, you grow up, you go to college, maybe you get a worldview, and then he says this happens.
Once you get a worldview, which is a lot of ideas that are in very complex circuits in your brain, and they become fixed. You use that worldview every day so that it's just natural. It's there, it's automatic, it's instantaneous, it's just present all the time. That becomes what I'll call a neural filter. Yeah. So if you can only understand what your brain allows you to understand. So a fact comes in. What happens if it doesn't fit your brain? One, you might notice it. Two, you could ignore it. Three, it can be changed in less than a tenth of a second. That's another thing we can get into.
Wait, let me make sure I understood. Facts can be changed in less than a tenth of a second? What?
So you're saying that information, much like time, is relative based on your worldview?
Based on your worldview. And
What does that mean for our fake news problem?
Yeah.
You got a big problem.
Yeah.
That's why the fake news is there. That's why it works.
One of the things that you point out in some of your research is that we will not just change information, but reject it. We may hear, because one thing we often counsel people in trying to fight fake news or fight propaganda or misinformation is to have an awareness, expose themselves to the other side. Mm. But your research seems to argue that that is totally ineffective, that by exposing them to the other side, they'll just reject it.
Not necessarily.
Okay, I mean, good. Hope.
Well, there is hope, and it's and that's very important to know. But it takes effort. That is, okay, I listen to Trump, I listen to all those guys, and I have to effortfully just say, hey, this ain't true, this ain't true, that, go on and on, And I know that. I know what's coming. I have to set up in advance. I know what to expect from them, so I can use my expectations of what's not going to be true to do that. And therefore, it's very important to understand how they are thinking. What they're about. You have to understand the other person. And it's a form of empathy. Empathy is not necessarily being sympathetic to someone else, but it has to do with really putting yourself in their shoes so you know what they're doing and what they could be doing to you.
Yeah, see, I think that's the critical point, right? And we started with the Make Me Smart thing, and two out of the three answers were about empathy. And I get the feeling another person's pain part, but the other part of it is, and this is really crude, knowing your enemy. Right? Mm. That's kind of what it is.
Yeah.
That's what Lakoff's saying.
I think so. Although, yeah, you really do have to know. And I feel like maybe it depends on your mindset. You know, there's that whole idea of like an open mindset versus a closed.
Mm-hmm.
And that the more you are exposed to another argument, the more you might be like, well, I guess that makes sense. But then on the other hand, George Lakoff's research and then some, not long after we talked to him, actually, there was a study published in Scientific Reports, maybe it was before, it was in January 2017, before, where they took these 40 people who were self-avowed liberals. They said they had really deep convictions, and they put them in an MRI scanner and started challenging their beliefs, like presenting them with contradictory data.
Did brains like explode?
their brains basically exploded. Yeah. They saw this more activation in the parts that are thought to correspond with self-identity and negative emotions. What they said was, people mistake ideological challenges as personal insults. And so they dig right in. Yeah,
which rings true today. I do wonder, though, whether American politics has always been this way. And yes, we had a civil war. And yes, in the early days of the Republic, because we've all seen Hamilton, there were horrible and scurrilous attacks, and I get that. But I wonder if we've always been as seemingly fixed as we are now, that people will take an intellectual political challenge as a personal attack, because you can't turn around now without one of those intellectual challenges being, you are a socialist. You know what I mean? Right?
Right. Totally. Yeah. I don't know.
But look, and this is going to sound, this is going to have echoes of Obama's American exceptionalism speech in Copenhagen in 2009. But look, we are supposed to be different. We are founded on ideas that were different. And we were supposed to be, from Reagan to John Winthrop, the shining city on the hill. Right? And we are supposed to enjoy and thrive on these challenges to ourselves that we can then take and learn and grow from. And the thing that's happening today is that we're not learning and growing from these challenges, right? We're digging deeper into our trenches. And instead of being the shining city on the hill, we're some faded relic of that ideal, which, okay, cue the dark sting, which we're going to get to, is a little dystopian, but it feels very tangible today on Election Day.
Yeah. It's hard not to be in a dark place now because I think you're right. We want to have faith that there is something about America that can overcome right. that, even though we know that those ideals were written by people in power who didn't necessarily think they should apply to all the people around them, and that it's always been a complicated ideal, that we have not always executed it faithfully, to say the least. But we want to. I hear what you're saying, that we want America to be better.
Point number three from George Lakoff, getting back to the task at hand. It's all about political messaging and how you might do political messaging differently depending on your worldview, what you think.
If you're a conservative and you go to college, what are you going to study? Most likely you're going to take some business courses, which means you're going to be taking a marketing course. And marketing professors study my field, cognitive science. They study that people think in terms of frames, metaphors, narratives, emotions, images, and so on. And so it's natural to be able to market your ideas if you're a conservative. But you don't take those courses if you're a progressive and you're interested in politics. You know, you don't take cognitive science or neuroscience or marketing. What you do is you take political science, law, public policy, economic theory, not business, and you learn a different way of thinking. Most of the Democrats I know a lot of wonderful people in the Democratic Party, and they have the following properties. They're very smart. They're very well-intentioned. They have very good values. They work hard. They're honest, and they get it wrong. Mm-hmm. And they get it wrong because they went to college and they did so well. Mm-hmm. And they've been using it all their life. And it's hard to change, when that happens.
Look, so the Republicans have, for decades now, right, been the meaner, tougher street fighters. And the Democrats have been the, no, let's be thoughtful and caring and this and that. And I get what Lakoff is saying, and I get his message. But it's interesting, especially as we translate that interview from a year and a half ago to today. Something I read, oh my God, I think it might have been on Twitter, actually, a good thought coming out of Twitter, which was that if you want the norms to be upheld, you have to uphold the norms. That if what you see happening are norms being destroyed all over the place, which we are seeing today at a national political level and specifically coming from the White House, you can't, if you're serious about complaining about norms not being upheld, you can't actually say, well, he's doing it, I'm going to do it too. Because therein lies ruin.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you could argue is that the Republicans for decades now have not just been meaner and tougher, but embarked upon a very specific strategy that involved a lot of discipline, right? And it involves staying on board that ship, even if you do not like where that ship is headed. You don't break ranks because you win. I mean, it's a strategy for winning for 100 years.
Sure.
And it's fairly well documented, and it really involves some good marketing. Whereas that same discipline, that same unified behavior and maybe even that same just sort of consistency of like simple messaging is not necessarily present with the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Totally
and
agree.
Maybe still isn't, you know, totally maybe agree. Still isn't. I guess we'll find out. I was listening to a podcast this morning about, and again, caveat election day, about how historically there's always a flip during the midterms, that conditions, you would argue, have never been better for Democrats, and that if they still somehow fail, that there will be real questions about the strategy of the party compared to the, like, ruthlessly efficient strategy of the Republican Party.
How are we doing so far in the postmortem on 2016, which was, by any presidential election standards, a historic fail on the part of the Democrats? I'm not seeing a lot of good talking points and revised strategy and unification of message coming out of anywhere near the Democratic headquarters.
Right. No, in fact, the Democrats are still doing what they always do, which is eat their young.
Right.
You know, find ways to be mad at each other and embrace every distraction that comes along.
Yep.
Anyway, lots to think about as we head to the polling places today. And something to add on that, a shout out to the poll workers.
Yeah, totally.
The thousands of people. This is like... So I love this part of the show because it's so unsung hero. There are the people who set up the folding tables and the voting machines, and they answer questions. They're even translators, and they're on the front line. And apparently, there's nowhere near enough of them.
Here's the thing. The latest numbers from the U.S. Election Assistance Commission found 2/3 of local jurisdictions had a hard time getting enough poll workers for Election Day. It's gotten worse, actually, in the past decade. So we went out and caught up with one local poll worker in Washington, D.C., and asked her to tell us how she got into it.
I'm Dr. Dorothy Payne Bryan, and I'm 81 years old, and I live less than 2 blocks away. This is my first year. I've had friends who are on the board of elections, and they suggested that I do it. All I had to do was go on to the internet, fill out the application, and then they called me, told me that, hey, I was on, and told me that I needed to come in for training. The presentation was great. Very comprehensive and very easily understood and very well organized. The training was great. In fact, that's one of the things that I would like to do, is to become one of the trainers.
Amen. That was awesome. Holy cow.
I love Dr. Dorothy.
Right?
That is so
81.
Incredible. First time poll worker at age 81. Big thanks to our DC-based intern, Ariel Plotnick. She's only with us for a couple more days, and she went out and got that audio, which is fantastic. The Election Assistance Commission, by the way, is where you go if you, like Dr. Dorothy, would like to sign up to become a poll worker. We'll have the link at makemesmart.org.
And also, we'll be right back.
Oh, yeah. And also, we'll be right back with our fixations, even though we've done a few of them so far.
Yeah.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
Boom, we're back. How about that? Don't look at the computer to get your visual cues when audio is rolling. Remind me to tell you the story about interns at Marketplace editing on digital software. But that's a whole different thing.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to do some stuff that's been on our minds. Who's going first?
You go first. Guess as usual, I have two, so we're going to have a vote.
Oh, God. Molly? All right. So look, mine is pretty straightforward, and it's a recap of things I've been saying, maybe not here, but certainly on Marketplace and in the general public for a while now, which is that Jeff Bezos has just been screwing with us. As we all know, Amazon has been looking for a second headquarters for nigh on a year right now, probably more. A couple of stories in the last couple of days, most recently about from the Wall Street Journal saying, well, it's not really going to be one city that's getting 50,000 new jobs and $5 billion worth of investment. We're going to do two cities. And I think that stinks for two reasons. I think it stinks, first of all, because it's a lame-o excuse that they're going to split it in two. Because I don't actually buy that they can't find the tech workers and the infrastructure that they need in, say, New York or Washington, D.C. or whatever, right? Major metropolitan areas in this country can absorb that kind of stuff. You know, out in the heartland, those cities, they were never going to get it. And I think they've been frankly, played by Jeff Bezos. But here's the other part, and here's why it's so deeply cynical. Amazon went out and got what I imagine are big, giant RFP, requests for proposals from these cities. Mm-hmm. And in those RFPs, the cities disclosed all kinds of data about themselves, about the kinds of consumers they have, about how things are used, like infrastructure and transportation and data management and education levels and all of that stuff. And Amazon now has that data. Not only, by the way, does Amazon now have that data, which most, for the most part, private American citizens will not be privy to, but it also has tax incentive packages in the gazillions of dollars, which it will now maximize from, my guess would be, New York City and Washington, D.C., or the neighborhoods therein. It's going to get those economic incentive packages that it's going to leverage now to get more economic incentive. And I just think that stinks. And I think it's deeply cynical. And I think Jeff Bezos has been messing with us.
Yeah, I think so, too. That dude gets a really good edit. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the, speaking of ruthless efficiency.
A good edit. That's a good phrase.
Of his, thank you. Of maybe I watch too much reality TV. But when you look at the ruthless efficiency of his behavior, also not for nothing, what Amazon usually does when it entices third-party sellers to sell on its platform is collect data on which products sell the best and then make them itself. And presumably they could build their own city now with all the data they just collected.
Yeah, right. I mean,
just taking a little sci-fi.
They have all this data. Yeah.
Taking a little sci-fi. Yeah, also way to stick it to those coastal elites by situating yourselves.
Well, come on. I always thought I was going to go to Washington. Not only does he own a huge house and mansion, I'm sure there, but he owns the hometown paper, for crying out loud. Of course that's where he's going.
Very true.
All right, let's pick the Molly thing.
You're so right. Okay, mine came from a couple days ago, and I'm just going to stick with it, which was while we are so effectively taking all of the bait and dividing ourselves, we take our eye off of the ball, and that ball is all the money and the places all the money are. And so I noted a story in the New York Times about how in the last 2 years, the Trump administration has either declined to collect or declined to enforce billions of dollars in corporate penalties. For example, Barclays was supposed to pay nearly $7 billion to settle civil claims that it sold toxic mortgage investments that helped fuel the 2008 financial crisis. And those penalties have not been collected. No one has particularly pursued them. And in fact, the SEC and Justice Department reached a much lower settlement agreement in March for more like $2 billion. And so on and so forth. Walmart is another example. There's been a huge drop in penalties on all kinds of different companies and a much lighter touch toward the banking industry.
Huh.
Yep.
Well, there you go. I think, by the way, we've come full circle because mine was tech and yours was business. I'm just saying.
Wow. Look at us.
What? Little mind meld right there.
I think we might be learning from each other as we are exposed to more and more information.
Oh, my God.
It's working.
That's cool. That's cool. While we're ahead. Anyway, what else we got? Is there music coming up to get us out of this? Come on. There we go.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
That's my favorite ever. Slightly different, but maybe related. So look, we're going to talk about our episode last week on polling and what it is all about, honestly, in this day and age. And you remember in that conversation, I prefaced my remarks by saying I'd been speaking to Larry Rosen, who does polling at Edison Research. He's the director of polling, maybe even the president, I think. And they also are the ones who do the Marketplace Edison Research National Economic Survey that we just came out with our seventh installment of about 3 weeks ago. Anyway, so Larry and I chatted before the interview. He listened. He is a listener to this podcast. And he sent me a note with some thoughts on what we had talked about with Lynn Vavreck from UCLA. And here is part number one of what Larry said.
Your guests seem to leave you with the impression that political polls only call landline phones. In fact, that's not the case at all. Most polls will now call many more cell phones than they will call landline phones. And in fact, the day is in the very near future where probably all the calls will be made to cell phones and none anymore to landline phones.
Yes. Any errors we should say are mine on that one. It was our error, not necessarily
our error.
Just for the record.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. And also, I sincerely did not know that. That's interesting. Yeah. Larry also wanted to offer his take on why polling did not predict that Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania were going to Trump. A burning question, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Most of those polls were finished more than a week out from the election. If you look at the exit poll results in those states, a lot of people waited until the very end to make their decision. And among people who waited till the end, they overwhelmingly broke towards Trump. And so had those polls just been done a little bit later or a little bit closer to election day, they may have better predicted Trump's victory there.
So there you go.
Yep.
From a master of the polling genre, as it were, Larry Rosen at Edison Research.
I love, too, that he just was like, I got to get in on this. I can't take it.
Oh, I know, right?
It's my thing.
This is, I mean, yeah.
It's his thing.
Yeah, and you should hear some of the conversations we have before our polls come out when we're going over the questions and this and that. Larry is, like, engaged on this on a superhuman level, so it's fascinating to hear him as an observer and a commentator.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I did notice in the feedback to that episode is that pollsters are a passionate bunch, which is kind of delightful.
For sure.
It really is just, it's a real science that everybody's really passionate about.
All right. So as we wind our way to the close, a letter note about a dark place, really, this dark place sting that I think there is a cry out there for. So we did a little bit of it last week. We're going to do some more this week. One of our listeners, Scott Meldrum, described it as the sound to play when you, quote, feel the weight of the world, unquote. So we played some options. We picked one. We also opened it up to you for more ideas. Remember, the rules are 4 seconds long, not Eve Tro, 18 seconds long. And also, they have to have like a dark vibe. Here is Scott Meldrum's Dark Sting. Yeah, too slow. Too slow. Sorry, too slow. Gut reaction. Stings for me are a gut thing.
And yet, it has to be kind of peppy also. Dark.
It has to have a sense of motion. It can't just be wah, wah, wah.
It's like Kai applies the obscenity standard to sting.
Yes,
judging.
I'll know it when I see it.
He'll know
it
when
he
sees it.
So now what?
Next, we have Chris Palmisano from Chantilly, Virginia. And he wrote, "Hey, gang, I heard you were looking for a dark sting, and I think I found the perfect little ditty." So let's hear it. Believe me when I
said to you, I was gonna Get it? That's pretty good.
The Russians love their children too part. That's really funny. I don't know if we have the rights to that.
Dark sting.
Way to go with the pun there.
Oh, man. That was a good one. All right. Mark Pedante collaborated with his 3.5-year-old son, Kerry, on this one. Here you go.
The dark place.
Oh, no.
What is that?
No. Not cool. No. October is over. We are not
also,
supposed to
I don't
get that
do
kind
scary.
Of thing.
Dark
no.
is not necessarily scary. Mark,
not
I really appreciate
cool.
you listening, but that was.
No. Like the creepy kid stuff, too, is like the all-time creepiest.
The dark place.
No. Ugh.
Okay. All right.
This one is going to be basically a chaser because we got to get that out of our heads. Mark Scholl created this one for us. Let's see.
All right, you're going to kill me. It's a little too peppy. It's a little too peppy. So we bookended it. We had one that was too slow, one that was too peppy. I still like the one that we picked from last week.
I do,
which,
too.
If the producers are prepared, they have in the sound bank. I really like that vibe. So
it's
if you're going to
so
come
good.
Up with a winner, it's going to have to be better than that.
It's okay.
So good. That's awesome. Props to the producers.
I do want to point out, though, that Mark Scholl's sound had a really nice Metallica thing going on.
Kind of.
That I, as a little old rocker, kind of loved.
So I'm going with one from last week.
Me too.
Send us a couple more. Because I think there's fodder here. There's fodder here. Also, of course, the Make Me Smart question, not necessarily about empathy and things that are getting you down, but stuff you've been thinking about, because that matters as well. Join our Facebook group if you like. Lots of discussion there about our discussions. And you guys are great, by the way, at keeping it civil. Yes, I do lurk. I'm not a participator on Facebook really so much. I've got time for one social media network in my lifetime, and it is Twitter. Sorry. But if you go to Facebook, search for Make Me Smart, it'll pop right up.
It will. And we hear you on the non-Facebook options, but right now, that's where you are.
I'm just going to let this music play for 2 seconds. A little palate cleanser. All right, Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. I kind of jumped right in there, didn't I? This week's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. The theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
I know. I couldn't even tell if that was on the beat. The executive director of On Demand is Zatara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager, who I would like to report, based off of last week, does indeed have to buy me a new laptop. It did not survive. That would be one.
And this is how we know whether she's listening or not, because did you get your new laptop in the mail?
Nope.
Thanks, Deb.
Thanks, Deb.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.